Blog Talk Radio.
Well, it looks like our intro music did not cue in tonight, so I think we're starting the show right away here with no delay. But this is episode number 137 of the Star Chamber Show. And I, of course, this is Steven Zimmer, and I'm here with you on a Halloween evening. And I'm with the one and only Michael West and Daniel Dark. You couldn't ask for two better co-hosts on a Halloween evening. I mean, just can't beat it. So you've definitely got the right setup for tonight. Welcome aboard, David and David, Daniel, and Michael. And I was going to say David because I just saw that David Sheridan has entered the chat room. But so I had him on my brain here. But Daniel and Michael, welcome.
Hello.
So he is in the chat room, I promise.
You forgot my name already.
No, I just opened up the chat room, which is live, by the way, folks. So if you haven't logged in, please do. And yeah, be sure to harass Mr. Sheridan. He's in there already. So, but yes, Daniel and Michael, yes, it's Halloween. So, yeah, give us some scoop on what you guys are doing for the big night, other than the current hour.
Oh, well, other than the usual, I mean, horror writers don't take a day off, and for me, every day is Halloween anyway, but other than the normal writing schedule, I went and saw the new Halloween movie for a second time.
Very cool. Yeah, Holly and I just recently saw that ourselves with my sister. We actually took my sister for her birthday because she was dying to see it, and really did enjoy it. I do want to discuss it with you, Michael. We'll save that for later privately. But yeah, it was definitely a very enjoyable film, and we had a lot of fun watching it here in Lexington.
Yeah,
so it's doing pretty well too. So
yeah.
Hopefully, they'll find a way to continue this franchise.
Yeah, it's cool to be able to see a Halloween movie on Halloween in the theater with a crowd. It's definitely something that we haven't been able to do in quite some time. And so it was, and of course it's great to have, the original, the band back together, so to speak, when you've got, Jamie Lee Curtis, John Carpenter and, Nick Castle as the Shape. So a lot of winks and nods and Easter eggs to the entire series, even though they ignored the rest of the series. But a lot of
almost there. I really miss Loomis, though. God, I miss Donald Pleasance. Oh
yeah,
man. I wish he was still with us, so he could have been in that. But I definitely agree with you. Yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis was awesome. I want a house someday that's fortified like hers.
Oh my God,
that was spectacular.
It's funny, if you stay for the credits, there's a whole lengthy section of the credits that's nothing but Lori's compound. It's a heading. It's like Lori's compound team, and then it just goes on and on and on about all the people that were involved in creating that compound.
Oh, they must have a blast. That, no pun intended.
Oh yeah,
but that was one cool setup. Not good for intruders, but yeah, definitely a good home defense system.
She had it all, definitely. It's even better the second time, because the first time, you're watching it, you're like going, okay, how are they going to screw this up? And then once you see it, you're like going, okay, all right, they did okay. Then the second time you can just let it go and watch it. And it was cool the second time, especially when you know what's coming up when you're waiting for the crowd reactions, and then the crowd reactions come. It's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Whenever you get a good crowd, it's really into it. I mean, it always makes the theater experience, be what it should be. And that's what I like to be a part of.
And then over the weekend, I happened to catch a film that was kind of here and gone. I didn't get to see it, you know, when it was, you know, when it opened, and they had it back in theaters, like, you know, in my area, they had it back in theaters for a short time, just for the weekend, for Halloween, basically, but a movie called Hellfest.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the best slasher movies, original slasher movies, it's not part of a series or whatnot, that's come out in many, many years. It was truly, truly disturbing, and unfortunately, you know, you could see it happening in real life, which is always makes it, you know, more scary when you can think about, you know, the fact that this could happen to you.
Oh yeah, and I've heard a lot of good things. Actually, one of our recent guests, film director Tori Jones, who was a recent guest of the Star Chamber show, he was talking about it in glowing terms online. He said he even liked it better than Halloween, and he had already talked about how much he liked Halloween, but he said this was like a real gem in the horror genre.
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm hearing that from multiple people that definitely know their stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing is, you know, as a horror writer, you know, it's like I always preach to people, you know, when you're writing horror, one of the things that I tell new writers or people who ask me for advice is to get people to read your stuff who aren't necessarily fans of the horror genre, just simply because people who see horror movies all the time and whatnot can be more forgiving of some of the cliches. You know, why do people act this way? Well, they act this way because it's a horror movie and people do stupid things in a horror movie. But but people who aren't as loving or forgiving of the genre will take it to task and say, well, there's no way in hell that this person would do what they just did. You need to find a way to make it more plausible and whatnot. And so it really helps to elevate your storytelling and your fiction and make it more believable and make your characters a little more, you know, realistic and more relatable, that people, you know, are doing, you know, they're not doing stupid things for stupid reasons. And that was one of the things that I loved about Hellfest, is the fact that given that situation, the fact that they're in a haunted attraction, you know, you're more forgiving of strange things that you see, or you're questioning whether it's real or not, and you're like, well, it's you know, it's all part of the attraction. So the reason why they would do some of the things that they did is because they're paying for it, basically, you know. You're mm-hmm. you're in there to be scared, and so, you know, it's like the security. They go, at one point they go to a security guard to complain about this, that, and the other. It's like going, you know, are you scared? You're paying to be scared, you know.
Right.
People are doing their jobs. So it's
very cool,
especially the ending. The ending is really chilling. I can't recommend that enough. So if you didn't get to catch it when it was in theaters, make sure that you get it on demand or Redbox it or whatnot. But it's definitely worth a look.
Is it out on
DVD
now? Well,
that amp.
Not yet. It's some theaters are still showing in some areas, but in my area it was just showing basically, you know, late night this weekend. But it's still considered first run, so. It'll probably be like February, March. It'll probably be out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, because the windows are so tight now. I mean, stuff comes out on DVD and you know, is rentable like pretty much instantly. And that's definitely not the case that we have to wait months for the DVD release anymore. But
I look forward to the day when basically you go and see the movie, and if you like it, you can buy the Blu-ray out in the lobby. You know?
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
It's like it's the windows are getting so tight that one day I foresee that happening.
Yeah, but it's so fun to see your Facebook feeds with the, hey, look what I got in the mail today, Michael West posts with shiny new, like, memorabilia and DVDs. Man, you have been kicking some butt on that lately. Yeah, another one today, I think.
Yesterday I got some Blu-rays.
Or yesterday. There's two DVDs. Nicholas, I just can't remember what they were, but it was,
It was Nicolas Cage's last movie, Mandy, which I have not seen yet, but I hear nothing but good things about. And then a classic Roger Corman movie from the 60s, The Wasp Woman.
Very cool.
Which is a gem. It was funny because a couple of years ago, there was this commercial that was playing on TV where they talked about this cosmetic or this cream or whatever, and they said, you know, made with royal jelly from, you know, I'm like, did no one see The Wasp Woman? Has no one learned anything?
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, man.
Or The Bee Girls, either one.
that one I haven't seen, but the Wasp Woman I saw for, you know, it played at one of those, like, you know, after school, you know, we used to come home from school and there'd be this is before there were like talk shows and whatnot on all the time, but there used to be like in the afternoon, like around 3 o'clock before the nightly news came on, they would show old movies and every week they would have a theme or whatnot. And so you used to hurry home from school so that you could see the classic horror movies, and sometimes they, you know, have.
What do you mean old movies? They were brand new movies when I was a kid, Mike.
Yeah.
We saw them first run in the damn theaters. I'm sorry.
Well, they had cinemas in the early 1800s. My God, that's pretty cool.
Well, that always cracks me up when they have Spider-Man say, "You remember that really old movie, The Empire Strikes Back?" I'm like, "Oh God."
Oh yeah, I know how you feel, Mike. I have to deal the same comments myself. Yeah, I love the old rock. I love the old movies, and they'll cite something from the 80s or whatever, and I'm like, oh boy.
Right. It's like, you know, Ozzy's Boneyard. Okay, that's classic rock, but you know, when they start, you know, Stryper and stuff like that is now classic rock. I'm like, come on, oh my God.
Yeah, no. It's daunting.
How old does rock have to be before it's classic, Stephen?
God, well, anymore, I guess. It's, that
5 years.
Upper's almost the 90s now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess they're going by the car scenario. It's like if a car is 25 years old or more, it's considered a classic. So by that standard, I guess all the rock from the 80s that we loved is classic rock.
Yep. Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a whole other show right there. Oh, man. Well, you should have sold tickets to tour your author space to view your museum tonight. That
would have been Well, it's funny because my son's having people over tonight for a game night, movie night, and he brought them into the office because all the horror movies are here in my office. So,
imagine
that. Basically, there was an impromptu tour.
That's awesome. Oh, my God. Well, we have one thing I do want to mention, though, before we get to our guest tonight, though. We actually did have a surprise release from Pearl Moore today, which is really cool because it was all his idea, and so I'm not taking credit for the idea on it, but we did cooperate and facilitate it. But it was he wanted to announce and release a novelette on Halloween, and so he has a new one out called Mommy and the Satanists, which is actually it's a provocative title, but it's dark humor, horror, and thriller elements kind of woven all together, and it is a blast. It is a fun short story, so I wanted to make sure, before we get our guest on tonight, that we mention that release because it's on ebook for 99¢ on Kobo, Kindle, and Nook, and it's one that I know both of you guys would just absolutely get a kick out of. You guys would be smiling and chuckling and all kinds of stuff. It's a real fun story. It's one of those very, very fast read fun ones. So that's cool. I can't stop staring at the cover. The cover art is so good. It's so nice.
Beautiful at the cover of the cover. The girl on the cover. Which one?
Yes. And Holly knows. Holly already knows. So I'm not going to get in trouble for saying that on the air. that cover art is pretty darn good. But
if people have not read Slash of Crimson by Carl,
yeah,
that's another good book of tales.
That's
and
a
stuff
great
that he
collection.
Does, so.
Yeah, it's a collection of horror, alt mythology, and crime noir, and it's a real nice mix of stuff. There's two novellas in it, as well as short stories, and it's he's definitely shows that he's got a very high potential voice in fiction in that release. And so, yeah, if you enjoy Mommy and the Satanists, definitely want to pick that one up. Yeah, Carl is a very dedicated guy when it comes to his writing. And, we need to get him on sometime for a chat because he's just a lot of fun to talk to. He can wax eloquent on everything from bourbon to wilderness skills to life.
We had him on once, but that's been a while back.
Yeah.
So.
That's right. But he's fun. He's a lot of fun. And, he was here at the last Imaginarium, but he told me today, he absolutely 100% said he definitely will be here next year. So that's something we can look forward to. But tonight though, we do have a Halloween special, my friends, and I'm definitely stoked about our guest tonight, who is a Bram Stoker Award winner. And of course we here at the Star Chamber show, we love Bram Stoker Award winners. That's definitely on top of our echelon of awards that we love here. And he's also a finalist for the Shirley Jackson Award and the Scribe Award. And he has published close to 40 novels and 3 collections of short stories, so got a lot under his belt. And then he's also a tenured professor who teaches creative writing at Sinclair Community College in Dayton, Ohio. And, yeah, just definitely one of the best guys around you'll meet in the literature world. And I am proud to bring you on Halloween evening for our special, the one, the only, Tim Wagner. Welcome to the Star Chamber Show, my friend.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you could make time. Glad. Hope we didn't interrupt any kind of big Halloween plans that you might have had.
No, it was misting rain here tonight, so we didn't have a lot of trick-or-treaters.
We got hit with the rain, too. They shifted our trick-or-treating to Tuesday night. So, unfortunately, when I came in, like I was telling the guys, on Tuesday, we actually missed it because we got in, like, about 5:30 and then found out, oh, they're trick-or-treating at 6 p.m. tonight. So, yeah, we totally missed the whole thing. So, Holly and I were a little bummed about that. But then again, you know, like I said, we're very excited to have you. So, you're going to rescue our Halloween for us.
No pressure.
and, of course... And that is the Michael West. Yes, we actually got Michael out of the usual rotation that we have here on the show to be here tonight to join with us to co-host you. So he'll have all the dirt on you because he's known you the longest of the three of us. So we'll leave it to him to bring up the good stories. But what's happening with you? Just saw you at Imaginarium. Of course, I'm getting pulled in 50 directions there, and I don't get to catch up with everybody like I'd like to. But how have you been doing? What's been going on since Imaginarium, and where are things at now?
Well, things are good. Semester is moving along, you know, my college, and at this point, I'm not working on a new novel. I'm waiting for approval for a proposal for a tie-in. And I have been writing some sample chapters for proposals. My agent's like, you know, don't slack off. Do something when you have some downtime. So I've been doing that.
Well, I know balancing give you a little bit of my background. My dad was a professor. He's in cancer research and taught at the University of Kentucky. And but balancing, to kind of translate into the writer world, his writing was like our, you know, like our writing would be like his research world. And then, you know, he also right. taught. And balancing those two worlds, you know, one, you know, obviously the more teaching side, one the more creative side, was always a fine art. And that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you to kind of kick things off. And I know Michael and Daniel, you know, have stuff they want to talk to you about. But, yeah, how is it balancing the realms of academia with the creative world? Because just knowing from my dad and many, many colorful comments he made to me throughout the years, I mean, it's not always the easiest thing.
Well, I think, you know, because I'm teaching writing, I think it really helps a lot because it keeps my mind in, like, focused on writing most of the time. And it's teaching is nice, too, because it gets me out of my own writing. It gets me thinking about other people, and I think about how, what are these people trying to say? How can I help them say it better? How can I help them solve problems in their writing? And that just plugs right back into mine. And it's kind of a nice break, too, to focus on other people instead of yourself for a while. And then, the actual work schedule waxes and wanes a little bit because I'm not grading papers all the time, at least not at the very mm-hmm. beginning of the semester. And, you know, it heats up a little bit later on, but it's just kind of a matter of juggling things. And it's not, I don't know, I've been doing it for a long time, so it's not that difficult. Although, you know, I'm starting to look forward to retirement for the first time in my life. So I won't have any more compositions to grade, and I can just write.
Right. My dad also looked forward to the day that he could just solely focus on research. He talked about that quite a bit as well. But right. So I definitely understand that. But there are definitely, I know, rewards on the teaching side, and especially when you get students that, you know, are real focused and passionate about what they're doing. That definitely has got to fire you up a little bit. And they respond and engage as opposed to, you know, not.
Right. But, you know, I really like teaching the beginning composition students because they don't have any kind of illusions about writing. They just do it. They're not trying to do it for a career. They don't worry about it. And they produce some really good writing because of that. And a lot of them think they can't write. And think it's impossible for them. And when you get to show them that they can, they're so appreciative. And you really feel like, you know, you've done something pretty important for people. So as much as I love teaching creative writing, I get a lot out of teaching composition, too.
Yeah, the closest I can relate to you on that is when I've done a few workshops for younger students that have never mm-hmm. really done creative writing things and just doing their first ever kind of creative writing exercise or something like that, and just seeing, yeah, definitely that light kind of switch on. I mean, that's definitely, I mean, you're on a whole different level working on that.
Right.
But it's I can see what you mean. Yeah, with when you're working in that kind of environment, that's awesome. That's awesome.
What type of technique do you use to get somebody that doesn't think they can write at all to realize that they can?
Well, a lot of times it's listening to them talk about whatever it is that they want to write. You know, we spend so many, who knows how many more hours forming ideas with our voices than we do any other way. And it's really natural for most people. But for some reason they don't connect. You can talk to somebody about what they want to write for an hour, and then you say, write that down. And they're like, what did I say? It doesn't seem to flow real well for them between the speech and the text. And so if you listen to them a little bit and you say, I think that sounds really good. That's a really good idea. Or this would be a great way to start it. And so then they realize that they can come up with stuff. It's not like creativity is some great big mystery. And then the other thing is if they've written something and you tell them, you know, this is good and this is why it's good, they're shocked because they often don't get that kind of feedback. One of the problems with teaching is that it's like if you work in car repair, you know, you don't tell people for 20 minutes everything that's great with their car. You tell them everything that's wrong, how much it's going to cost, and how long it's going to fix it, because that's what you have to do, and you have to move on to the next car after that. And people teach, or they teach like that. You know, they will just point out the things that are wrong in a document and assume that people understand that everything else is fine, but they don't. The message that they get is all your feedback is about things that are bad, things that, you know, need to be improved. And so if you can remember to give feedback in terms of what really works well, too, it makes a huge difference for people.
Very good.
you have some comments on that, Michael?
No, I agree with him. I mean, that's one of the things that I'm lucky in that my pre-readers and I have, you know, since they've basically been with me since the beginning, and I have a really good rapport where they'll point out the stuff that works, but then they'll also point out the stuff that doesn't, and more important than that, they tell you why. Which, you know, I mean, you can tell somebody this is great or this sucks, but if you don't tell them why, you know, it's not, you know, as helpful.
I've always thought, in my experience growing up and seeing different creative writing instructors and things like that, I've always felt that's the big difference between the ones that do a lot of damage and the ones that really inspire and uplift writers. And it's the ones that that tell you the why, and you do realize that it's constructive criticism and not just, you know, lambast you kind of stuff.
Right.
And I've experienced both. So yeah, I definitely can vouch for how you feel after dealing with both styles. But yeah, that's what I'm hearing from both you and Tim on this.
No matter what the creative process, whether it's film or creative writing or music or whatnot, it's like you have to learn to kill your children. You know, it's like you spend all this time and you put all this blood, sweat, and tears into it, and everything that you've done. You know, the book is your baby, or the song is your baby, or the movie is your baby, and you don't want to cut any part of it or you know, but you know, sometimes, you know, if people will tell you that stuff has to go, and you have to trust it and you have to listen to it, and you know, I'll never forget a mutual friend of ours, Maurice Broaddus. He on one of my novels, he told me that I needed to cut basically everything from point A to point B, and I was like, how can the chapter possibly work if I cut everything from point A to point B? There's no way that will work. And I said, well, I'll copy it over to another document and I'll do it just to show him that it doesn't work. And I did it, and I'm like, God damn it.
That's awesome.
He was right.
No, it's true. Yes, yeah. Sometimes you gotta make the big slices in there to make something work. And but as long as you know it's coming from a person that has your best interests and is being constructive, as you know, in terms of their feedback and criticism, you know, that's the key. That makes all the difference in the world. And that's
right.
Yeah. And I know that. And oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I know Tim has talked about people who have taken his criticism the wrong way, but I can't honestly imagine anyone getting criticism from Tim and not, you know, I mean, the way Tim approaches things, I can't imagine anyone getting criticism and not taking it in the best possible way.
Well, I hope. I don't usually get people that seem to be upset, but there's been a couple times where people have just kind of approached me through email and said, oh, could you please read this? And then I'll read it and give them feedback and never hear again. So not sure, you know, how that was taken, but that's only been a couple times. Most of the time people seem to be pretty grateful and, you know, they seem to feel like, you know, I help, which is my only goal, so.
Well, I know that year in, year out from our end, you know, in our little sphere at Imaginarium with the workshops you've done there, with us since the beginning. I mean, it's year in, year out. You know, we always get glowing comments back from the attendees. And they're always like, yeah, I hope, yeah, please bring him back next year. Of course, yes, he's got an eternal green light at Imaginarium. He knows this, and, yeah, he's, as long as he wants to be here, he can be here. So, but we definitely get that vibe from all the people that talk to us. So, yeah, no question about that, Michael. Yeah, Tim's got that for sure.
Well, one thing that I always talk about and everything when it comes to Tim is the one that he was the first person that gave a workshop that I went to after becoming a writer.
You even got beat what? There. Somebody did.
Yeah,
after becoming
me.
A writer and everything, he taught the first workshop that I had ever gone to. And I got so much out of that workshop. And it was at Imaginarium.
Mm-hmm.
That first year I was at Imaginarium.
That would be 2016 at the Crown Plaza.
2016.
That's the first one you went to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was just beginning to work on knife steel at that time and, you know, learned how to, you know, sort of ramp it up a little bit to where it's actually, you know, worth, you know, according to some people, worth reading. You know, so, and, you know, that was where I came, you know, where I learned the first basics of horror writing was through Tim.
Very cool.
I'm glad I could help. Well, Tim, I know that you just gave a talk recently about why horror matters, and not that I want you to repeat the whole talk, but mm-hmm. with it being Halloween and whatnot, I thought it'd be appropriate if maybe you went into a little bit about why we do what we do and why it matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I did it that talk for In Service Day at the library in downtown Dayton, and I did a small kind of altered version of it at my college, too. The one for the librarians was about talking about not only why it matters so that people understand the, you know, the genre's importance a little bit more, but also trying to give them some guidance and helping guide patrons who are interested in reading horror, you know, help them find what they would like. But, you know, one of the big things I talked about was that the level of catharsis that you can get in horror and the level of being able to deal with material and feelings that are dark in a way that's just ultimately safe. I mean, you can always put the book down. You can always, or stop the movie. You know, you can always get up and leave the theater. You can pause and come back to it. Last week, my wife had never seen Halloween, so the original, so I put it on, and she stopped halfway through because of the suspense, and about half an hour later, we started again. And you have all kinds of ways that helps you process that. And, you know, fiction can do that of any kind. You know, it can help you connect to people that are not like you, can help you experience all kinds of things safely. But I think horror fiction is unique in the way that it can deal with, like, our darkest impulses, that it can deal with our nightmares, and it gives us a chance to explore our dark side in a safe way. It doesn't hurt anybody, doesn't hurt us, and it gives us a chance to make peace. At least as much as we possibly can with the darkness that we all have in us.
Very cool.
So when you're writing, Tim, is there is every book that you write a piece of you, or is it a piece of somebody else that you're just putting words to?
You know, probably more, you know, a piece of me than anybody else. I mean, it might be something I've seen, or it might be based on somebody I know, but it's still my interpretation. You know, it's like I started off in college as an acting major, and it's no matter which character you play, I mean, you're always creating it out of yourself because you don't have anything else. I mean, you can observe stuff, you can talk to people, but everything you take in is part of you, and that's the only thing we ever have, you know, to make what we make. But, yeah, I do try to take, like, little elements of myself, and I take bits and pieces of my real life and put it in there, and, you know, people can't always tell because I'll change it a little bit or whatever, but I feel it gives it a little bit more emotional authenticity when you do that. It's one of the things I learned in acting classes, to take, you know, like pieces of authentic emotion that you might have experienced and use that as kind of the fuel for whatever you're acting. So I try to do that in my fiction. So I say it's more me than just me kind of, you know, imagining other people. Probably for like the tie-in fiction, a lot of times it's, even though I imagine myself as the characters, there's probably less pieces of my real life in there just because I'm already dealing usually with like a set world. They're set characters.
Very good.
Yeah, because that was actually one of the things I wanted to kind of explore with you is because I do know you do a lot of tie-ins and you do get to play in established worlds, and making that taking from your own voice and then having to kind of meld that with a tie-in situation or an established world and kind of the your take on how you approach melding those things together. And you got touched on a little bit there, but yeah, definitely love to hear you expound on that a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah, I think that my acting background, even though it was limited to mostly high school and just a few acting classes for a couple of years in college, because I shifted over to English education, but my acting background I think really helps, because that's how I imagine doing it. You know, I imagine that I am acting in like maybe an episode of a TV show, or maybe I'm the director of a TV show. And so, like, if I do a tie-in for Supernatural, I imagine, how would I not only write the script, but how would I direct it, how would I act it? And I just put myself into the place of the characters, too. But I also try to do like a director would, in terms of try to grasp the feeling of this particular property, whatever, like the script that you're doing, to create a feel for it. And it really helps because, it already exists. So I can get a feel for what's already there. There's already speech patterns to listen to in terms of actors. If it's a tie-in that where it's like set in a basic world, but the story is all original, it's all mine, that's easier, of course, because I can make up the characters myself. But I still want to get the feel of the property. You know, I usually tell people that like, for example, The Lord of the Rings, Middle-earth, Narnia, Oz, Westeros, they're all fantasy worlds, but all of them feel so much different than each other. They have different kinds of stories that take place there. They have different kinds of ways the characters interact. But, you just say the names and you have a feeling for what kind of world they are. And so that's one of the biggest things that I try to do is get that, because I think that's what makes a world feel like the right world to readers.
Yeah, I always love writers that can go into somebody else's world and put their own voice to it. And, just to use one other example, I think R.A. Salvatore does it really well with the Driss DeJordan novels. And I know I probably botch that pronunciation every time, but the Dark Elf novels.
Right.
And they are, his voice shines through. But again, he's, having to work with their rules to an extent. But that's definitely, I think that's a challenge for a writer, as opposed to when you get to go in and from the ground up, set everything. it's definitely a different beast. But I did not know you had an acting background, though. I guess I've been living in a tunnel these past few years.
It was such a long time ago, and I only did like some plays in high school, and even though I took some acting classes in college, I never tried out for any productions because I realized that it wasn't what I wanted to do for my career. But, even that little,
right,
the mild training really helped a lot, when you apply it to writing.
Yeah. I agree. I'm in the same boat in that most of my plays and drama experience was in high school. I really didn't pursue it in college, but it has really helped me, especially with dialogue and character interaction, is just, be able to picture myself as an actor playing a role and trying to get into the head of the characters.
Yeah, I also draw off that just from being, I did a little theater in high school up until I hit college, but I do draw off that as far as my filmmaking side. As far as working with actors and screenwriting and things like that, I do draw off that when I, do that side of things, as far as the actors and that kind of voice when I do fiction writing as well. So yeah, definitely see where that's a huge benefit when you're writing a project.
Well,
and visualizing.
Tim, I know you've talked about this online before, but that you're grateful that the studio didn't cut some of the stuff that you put into this tie-in or that tie-in. But obviously, since you're playing in someone else's sandbox, they probably have the final say. How often do you feel like you were able to put your own voice or your own original spin or your own take
on some of these properties?
You know, it's odd sometimes the things that they'll, you know, people will want to take out and things that they'll want to leave in. But there's a good chance to do it. I mean, you still get to create, unless it's like a novelization of a film, you get to create the whole story. So the story itself that you might tell would be your own personal stamp. So like for the supernatural stuff that I've written, the stories have all been stories that either, you know, they come out of, you know, my own imagination, so, you know, mine, not just like a generic imaginative story. One of the books I did for Supernatural, I took a premise I came up with in my early 20s for a novel that I just never wrote. I'm like, I can take that and use that for this book. And then when I did, like, the novelization for Resident Evil, the last film, the number 6, I think, there's a huge gap between movie number 5, which ends with,
yes,
now we're going to have this gigantic battle against, like,
right,
a horde of all these things, you know, in the Capitol building. And then the number 6 opens up with, I guess it's all over, and Alex,
right,
just crawls out from an underground bunker, and there's no mention of what happened, or there's no mention of, there's no bodies around, there's no mention of all of her allies. And so, you know, I wrote like 50 pages of that. I just wrote a battle. I created the whole thing, and I created it so there would be no bodies left afterwards, and all kinds of stuff. And they let me keep all of that in. And so I got to write basically like, you know, Resident Evil 5.5. which was cool, and
well,
they let me like put. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, and I know a lot of Resident Evil fans thank you for that because they were disappointed because you're absolutely right. I mean, the last movie left you with this. Oh, I can't wait to see this, you know, and
right,
and then it just skipped to the next day or whatever.
Right, and all the characters, and you know, especially the little girl that she had to, you know, with like the daughter of one of her clones or something, or at least she was going to use or keep as her own daughter or take on the mantle of being her mother. That girl's gone. She's just gone in the last movie. And there's nothing.
Right.
So I was able to put her back in toward the end too. And the only thing that the Resident Evil people changed was that, you know, Alice loses a couple fingers toward the end of the movie. And I guess they changed the number of fingers from the script to the film. So they changed that in my manuscript, and that was it. They let everything else, you know, let me keep everything else that I did. And I was able to go ahead and, like, the other thing I did, too, was I tried to tie it into as many of the other novelizations as I could. So, you know, I went back to those and tried to pull out little bits and pieces and try to make everything fit. So, you know, all that was just me having fun, and they just let me do all that. So it really depends. But sometimes in Supernatural, they'll say things like, well, you know, Reapers don't really do this. And I'm like, okay, fine. Or it's like, well, you know, this feels too science fiction-y, and we don't do that. I'm like, it's caused by magic. Okay, fine. I'll make it feel less science fiction-y. And so there's some of that. You know, there's some of that that goes on. But, I mean, by and large, you know, I don't have what they really haven't had any problems with great big things that have to be changed.
Well, as much Supernatural as you've written, have they ever come to you and said, hey, this season we'd like you to do a script for us?
No, as near as I know, that never happens. I think they see the skill set probably as completely separate. And besides, the people that do all the licensing, they're licensing people at the studio. They deal with all the licensed products, like T-shirts and toys and the books and the comics and whatever. They don't really have anything to do with the TV show other than having to make sure that all those products, you know, align with the TV show. So I don't even know if anybody on the production side of the show is even aware these books exist, to be honest.
Mm.
I hope they are, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're listening tonight and they'll know now.
Yeah, let's hope. Yeah. Yeah, and they're like, damn right, we don't want him writing one of those episodes.
Well, I used to get upset with Supernatural and Grimm because as soon as I would write a story that featured a creature from a specific mythology, they would do an episode that had the exact same thing.
Right, right. They just burn through those like nobody's business. Like, you have like a different one every episode.
Right.
And you're on for 5 years or whatever. You're gonna go through a lot. I did have trouble with that one because if you watch the show, that stuff doesn't make a lick of sense on how any of that stuff works.
Right.
Because it's like, because they kept telling me it was science. And I'm like, what do you mean it's science? It's like, oh, you know, it's like they can affect people's perceptions with, like, pheromones. And I'm like, what if they're across the street? They can't smell the pheromones. And they've
right.
shown that this effect translates to film. That and that most people can't see, like, you know, when they kind of, you know, briefly assume their animal form or whatever on film. But, like, the other ones can and the Grimm can. They can see it. Because they had, like, footage of Hitler and showed him being, like, the wolf character for a second. And it's like, there is no way that effect can translate scientifically in any way, shape, or form. So it has to be some kind of magic. But I had to come up with, like, and so the creature that I made up for my Grimm book, I based it on the doppelganger so it can, like, assume the form of people that it kills. And but also takes their personality on, too. But I had to come up with, like, biochemical reasons for this. So I had to do the normal, you know, the kind of BS that you do when you're like you see in TV shows and movies where they try to pretend something's science when there's no way it could
right.
be. And I guess they were finally satisfied with it, but I was just hoping that nobody would look at it too closely because there's just no way.
Yeah, I used to have a guilty pleasure of watching Zoo. During the summer. You know, the first couple of seasons stuck, you know, they adhered a little bit to the books, but they had their own spin on it. But it's like the further that show went on, the more fantastic and more improbable and impossible it became. And yet it's like, it was like, you couldn't look away, you know, it's like, you're like, they really think that people are going to buy this.
All right. Well, now I have to watch it because I listened to the first book on audio, and I'm like, I wonder if this will be any good or not. And so now that I know that it goes off the rails, I have to watch
it
to find out how it does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every season it just seemed to go further and further off the rails. just like, and by the end you're like, what?
That's
I was
awesome.
Really sad that they I was really sad that they canceled it because it was getting to the point where I'm like going, you know, how much crazier can this get, you know?
Yeah, well, I got to check it out. But I think there's like an impulse to create novelty in like something that goes on. I mean, it's like when Anne Rice suddenly decided her vampires were caused by aliens after 30 or 40 years or whatever. And I was like, what? So that's, you know, that's what she's doing in the books now. They're I don't know, I haven't read them, but I've read the reviews of them and stuff. So that's the big twist, is that they, you know, they're really aliens. And I'm like, this is not a big twist. This is what they did in Rocky Horror. It's nothing new.
Right.
The monsters are aliens. But I think there's just that kind of impulse to something that's going on long enough to throw a wrench into it, you know, and just make it more interesting. I haven't written a series more than just like 3 books, so I haven't done any, had a chance really to do that. But I can see the sort of the need for it in some ways.
Yeah,
trying to help out those people that did Zoo. I'm trying to justify their weirdness.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because it's you mentioned that. It's like I in book one I brought in aliens in my urban fantasy series, and it was one of the reasons why it had trouble, you know, finding a home, is because, you know, for the most part it's pretty Lovecraftian, pretty horrific, but then you bring in the sci-fi aspects and that just throws everybody's, you know, they're like, well, it's too sci-fi, we can't publish it as horror because it has these sci-fi elements. And then, you know, you take it to the sci-fi publishers and they're like, oh,
yep,
this is too horrific, we can't do this. So it's interesting that now, you know, like long established horror properties like the vampire series are going the sci-fi route.
Right. or the other way around, you know, where it's like something is supposed to be scientific, but there's like, after a little bit, there starts to become an air of mysticism about it, so.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I've pointed this out before in things that I've written, the fact that, you know, I've never done really anything straight up magic with spells being cast and whatnot, but, you know, it's like, you know, you look at science as the fact that, you know, people who look at some scientific achievements would see it as magic if they don't understand it, you know.
Right.
But I always loved I Am Legend, where, you know, he took mm-hmm. the very science, you know, the scientific route of trying to explain vampirism as, you know, as opposed to just, you know, oh, they're just supernatural creatures.
Right. Yeah, and that works really well.
Yeah.
Seems like vampires fit like a science fictional kind of basis better than just about anything, because they're still human enough, and they're still feeding,
right.
And, you know, werewolves not so much because of all the, you know, the changing you have to do. Same with zombies, because it's like, really, how do you keep from rotting after a while? Where
right.
does all that food go if you can't digest it?
And no one ever discusses the zombie poop.
Yes, they don't like, their stomachs haven't exploded yet. But I did write a zombie novel where I did all that stuff, but the zombies weren't technically dead. They still had biological processes, but they were unpleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in that one I had it's called The Way of All Flesh, and in their minds they didn't see themselves as zombies. They still saw themselves as human beings at a certain extent. And so, one of the main characters is a zombie who's trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
So what is, as far as the tie-in worlds that you've played in, Tim, what is your favorite one, or if you can say a favorite, and why?
Oh, man, that's rough. I got to do an X-Files story, which is really cool. I got to do a Doctor Who story years ago, which was super cool because evidently usually they don't let Americans write Doctor Who. So at least for that, that's what I was told. So the one anthology was called Destination Prague. So all the stories had to deal with Prague somehow. And originally I was going to get to do Doctor Number 6 because they only had the rights to do 1 through 8, I think. And, But then they said they had too many 6 stories, so I got 2, and it's like, Doctor 2 is fine. And then I came up with a story about space whales, and then like a year later it showed up on Doctor Who, and I'm like, damn it. And
right.
It's just a coincidence. I don't think for a minute that my story inspired anything, but I'm like, well, hell. So I'd say probably those two, just because, you know, that they're properties that I really liked a lot, and maybe Doctor Who, because it's not like you get much of a shot at it, you know, like you might other things. I really enjoy writing the supernatural books, too, because I just love the relationship between the brothers.
Yeah.
That's why always been my favorite part of the show. It gets hard to write, though, now, because you have to pretend that these guys could actually be threatened by a less-than-cosmic menace at this point. You know, it's
right.
hard to believe that they go toe-to-toe with Lucifer and God and all these things, and then next week a ghoul might eat them or something. It's like, really? Because unless they are way off their game that week. and plus their buddy's an angel who can just walk up to these things and destroy them with a touch. I don't know why they're even bothering. They just send Castiel out to do stuff. They should just walk on in, stick him on any monster, and then leave. So, you know, to write it, you really have to kind of pretend things. Like, you have to pretend that, yes, they are, like, the greatest hunters in the world, and they can stand toe-to-toe with God and Lucifer and everything. And you have to give them enough of a threat that they would need to handle it, but also pretend that they aren't, you know, quite maybe as super as they're shown in the TV series. Because otherwise, they just walk in and, you know, tear up your world like tissue paper and walk out. So I think that's a problem with a series that keeps on going as long as this did, because they kind of, it's like role-playing. You know, they've leveled up so much by this point that, you can't have them go into a dungeon and just fight like a goblin horde or something. They have to be fighting gods and things like that.
Right.
No, that's definitely one of the things that I always find a little tough when it comes to a lot of the superhero movies and things like that. It's always that believability that they're actually under a threat when they're just blasting their way through a city during one of their brawls and nothing even scratches them. And that's always been one of my problems with that kind of sphere. And that's why I've never been a big Marvel DC fanatic, but I do like to have believability as far as that's concerned.
The people that write these movies, they always think it's about like a hero beating on a villain, but really, like a hero like Superman, Superman's not interesting when he's like fighting something toe to toe. He's interesting when he has to figure out how does he use his powers. Because he could wreck the joint, like the whole damn planet, if he's not careful. And what does he do in terms of, like, helping humanity out too much or too little? What kind of moral dilemmas would he have? You know, you'd still have him fighting characters. And for Batman, you know, the dilemma for him is that, you know, does he allow that pursuit of justice to go too far? You know, his obsession with it. And especially if he has people, like, in the Bat family, like Robin and whoever, you know, what does this do to them? You can easily put that stuff in with them beating up on bad guys. And it would make the movie so much better because, you know, their threats aren't the bad guys so much. It's everything else in terms of them trying to deal with the lives that they have and the things that they're doing.
Well, and I think, Tim, you bring up an interesting point because I think that's why a lot of adaptations of horror novels, especially, you know, the work of Stephen King, you know, for me, the best Stephen King adaptations are the ones that really have no supernatural elements to them, like Shawshank Redemption or Stand By Me from the Body.
Right.
But you know, a lot of times when they go to adapt King or go to adapt Clive Barker or whatnot, it's about the big bad. You know, they focus on that. They don't focus about, you know, the interpersonal relationships or the inner struggles of these characters.
Right. You know, when I started reading King when Salem's Lot came out, back when I was in junior high, I think, and it's one of the first things that I noticed about, you know, not only his ability to create the suspense in a way that I hadn't seen before in horror fiction, but it was the way he dealt with characters that I hadn't seen. And that was the thing. I mean, nothing against the man, but, I mean, his monsters and ideas and concepts are not particularly, you know, unique by any means. What's unique is the way his people and how the people are affected by this and the way he uses this setting. And, yeah, so people miss that all the time. I think that I'll be looking forward to seeing Mike Flanagan's adaptation of Dr. Sleep because he did such a good job on Gerald's Game, which I did not think could be adapted into a film. And I thought that was really well done. So.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan, in my eyes, he's one of my favorite directors right now because everything that he's done – From Absentia on has just been just amazing.
Yeah, I was lucky at StokerCon in Long Beach because he was one of the guests and I got to chat with him at a party after the film contest. And that's when he didn't give away any plot details, but he was talking about how he was just getting ready to film The Haunting of Hill House, the series. And so we were talking about how, you know, streaming media like that you can binge is like the you can visually, in terms of like drama, create the effect that a novel could create. Because it's different if you're just watching a series because it could be spread out over weeks and years and months. But this thing could be completely self-contained from beginning to end. You could watch the damn thing in maybe a space of like, you know, half a day. So you could do it just like you could read a novel. And, you know, we were talking about all the different things you can do as a storyteller with that. And he was saying there are a lot of directors that are really intrigued by that now and are trying to find, you know, projects where they can do like a limited series that could then be streamed. So I'll be interested to see if that, you know, maybe more things, because a lot of King's works, I mean, especially the Dark Tower works, I mean, they would work really well as something that could be streamed and binged. So
right. Well, and And you know, because Toby Hooper was talking about this back when they were doing the Salem Slot in the 70s, the fact that, you know, that the network not only the network spread it out where it was two Saturdays. So you had, mm-hmm. you know, the first two-hour episode was on one Saturday, and then it was a whole week later before they had the other two-hour episode. And he's like, you know, we're trying to create suspense here, and, you know, how do you do that when, you know, it's spread out like that?
Right. And, you know, you binge and streaming, it's even different than if you have things on DVD or Blu-ray, because you don't have to get up eventually and change a disc. I mean, it could literally just keep on going from beginning to end, the way it's set up. So I think that you know, horror really lends itself to that, in the sense of people trying to actually get to the characterization better, as opposed to just doing, you know, like you said, the big bad. I really think Stranger Things
right.
had a huge impact on that, because it's so much
yeah.
about the characters, even though it has this cool world and other stuff that goes on and everything. But I think that showed a lot of people in Hollywood that, you know, character-based horror, at least horror that tends well to its characters, really could have an impact on the audience.
Agreed. Well, you're celebrating kind of an anniversary this year, aren't you, with regard to your first dark fantasy horror novel?
I'm not sure what you mean. Say that again.
Isn't this a milestone anniversary for your first dark fantasy horror novel, The Harmony Society?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. It's maybe 20 years or coming up on that, something like that. I know I wrote it 20 years ago. But it was originally published, I think, probably maybe 18 years ago or so, something like that. But, yeah, I'm coming up on a big anniversary of that. And it is just, it's kind of wild, you know, to think it's been that long.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Stuff comes up in my Facebook feed all the time where it's like, you know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, I'm like, going, really? Really? Was that long ago?
Yeah, but wasn't that last week?
Yeah,
I know exactly what you mean.
So what's going to be coming ahead of you now, as far as like some new releases that are coming up in Tim Wagner's world?
Can you give us some scoop on? Sure, I'm going to have a new book coming out from Flame Tree Press. I'm not sure when, but it's coming out soonish, I'm sure sometime in 2019. It's called They Kill, and it's actually my homage to like the Monster Rally movies, like House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein and Mad Monster Party. It's a twisted version of it, but I thought it'd be cool to have a book where there was like these, you know, several monsters in it that converge for whatever reason. And it's still the kind of weird dark fantasy stuff that I do, but I had a blast writing that thing. I got a supernatural novel, a new one coming out in February called Children of Anubis. And that was a lot of fun. I got to invent a whole new monster. I got to invent werejackals, basically.
Very cool.
Was awesome. Yeah, they just let me do it. And then I bring back Garth, their kind of geeky buddy who became a werewolf. And so he's in there too. I was afraid they wouldn't let me do it, but they did. And so I was really excited.
Was that in your synopsis that you were going to bring him back when you pitched it?
Yep. Yeah, I figured that, you know, I have him as a, since he's, you know, we never saw him as in action as a werewolf, as a hunter. At the end of the episode where we find out he's a werewolf, he's like, I'm going to come with you guys and use my werewolf powers to help hunt. And they're like, no, stay here with your wife and you're with your peaceful pack that you're in. And I'm like, okay, I've got to get him in a book. And that one was fun because I got to write about werewolves. And so just I could make those guys as mean as I wanted to, because there's also a family of werewolves along with a family of these werejackals that are kind of in conflict. And I had a blast writing that thing. So, you know, if people love Garth, then you're going to get plenty of Garth in that book. And if you hate him, there's plenty of Sam and Dean. So go ahead and do it anyway.
just I can't, unbelievable about your process is the fact that you write it all out longhand.
Yeah, most of the time I do. I don't know why. You know, it's just that that's the way I first started writing. You know, there weren't any PCs until I was like 18 or 19. And I learned to type when I was 16. So I started, on an old electric typewriter. And I wrote most of my very first novel when I was 18, 19 part of it on an old Royal that was a manual typewriter, then part of it on an electric typewriter. And then I think it was my second one that I wrote on a PC. So there's just something about the handwriting that seems to make it flow better, and I don't really know why. It's a pain in the butt because I have to type it all in again, and then I have to go through and fix all the damn typos that I made when I typed it in. But if it helps the words, flow, I just go with it. About the only time that I try to avoid that if I can is when I'm doing a novelization of a movie, because a lot of times the deadline's really short on those. At least they have been for the three I've done, and so then it's like, okay, I'm sleeping only 3 hours a night, and I'm going to be chained to my computer and do what I can to get it done. But it just seems to work pretty well that way, and I don't really argue with it. I mean, maybe someday I'll switch back to writing on the on the computer full time, and that's the only thing. That's how I'll generate the text in the first place. But I don't know. I try not to question it too much. Whatever gets the words flowing, it keeps them flowing. I'm happy.
Well, Daniel, I know you can relate to that because you're a longhand writer as well, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I write almost everything longhand and then retranspose it into the computer and fix things as I see them that time and then fix them several other times before I ever do anything else with it. So, yeah. That's how I learned how to write to start with,
Mm-hmm.
Tim's talking about being in junior high or high school when computers came out. I was, I didn't have my first PC until my middle daughter was in the fifth grade. So, we did it a little bit different back when I was a kid. I remember electric typewriters coming out and stuff like that. Everybody was excited about in typing class and stuff. So,
my first stuff was written on a word processing typewriter, where you'd get like one line typed on the little screen and then type. It was typewriter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and that was high tech back then.
Oh yeah, that was state of the art.
But I've been teaching for 30 years. I still get students all the time that they write first by longhand. So, these are people now that have grown up all their lives with computers and have grown up keyboarding since they were little. But they still, a lot of them prefer to write by hand. So, the computers may be there, but the hardware of our brains haven't changed much. So,
it's the same thing that a lot of them are wanting to go back to, actual physical books now compared to the Kindle and those books.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something about holding that book in their hand, they like. And I understand the, presence of it because I don't read anything on Kindle unless I just am forced to.
Right.
Or anything like that.
I like it because I can.
Well, that's an interesting thing with the younger generation, because I have talked to librarians that say that in high schools, that say that the high school students will actually opt not to get the ebook checked out version of a book. They will wait until the print version comes in to actually read the book. And that I'm talking about today, new generation coming up. Well, which obviously has grown up in the digital world, but they actually have gravitated toward the print versions. So throw that into the discussion. There's definitely something I think hardwired in the people with something tangible about it all.
Yeah, they've done a number of studies that show that, and I don't know why this is, but show that people have better retention when they read in print than if they read digital text. But they have no idea why. And I wouldn't be surprised that the tactile sensations of reading physical books just actually, because I know just from educational theory that the more senses you can stimulate at once, the more chance you'll have make a permanent memory because you have different pathways to reach that memory. Like you'll have a smell or a sight or a touch to reach it. And I don't know if you get that from digital. So that may be part of it. I don't know. I have no clue. All
well,
I know is at least right now.
Plus, for me, I know it's always easy, like, if I'm, like, reading and I'm like, what? When did they? And then I go back a few pages or whatever. That it's much easier to do that with a physical book than it is to scroll back through a digital book.
Yes, it is. And when you've, like, grown up reading, you can almost, like, just guess how many pages back it is and almost turn to it immediately because you know how far you've gone page-wise. And I can't tell that on a Kindle screen. I just can't.
No.
But I like reading on the Kindle. I like the fact that I can make the letters bigger because my vision's not as good as it used to be. And I like the fact that I can buy books in the middle of the night, which is like, it's like crack for me. I'm like, oh, my God. I can buy books anytime and download them. And I like being able to have tons and tons of books in one little space. And so does my wife, so they're not cluttering up the house. So that part's good.
Right. Well, yeah, my wife won't read any of my stuff until it becomes available on Kindle. She's like, I'll read it when it's on Kindle. I'm like, okay.
So there is something to it. I'm like Tim. I love the instant accessibility at any time. It's beautiful. When I do download something to my Kindle. And, it's always nice to be able to get that instant access. So especially when I'm actually researching about something on a writing project, it's great to be able to pull a history book that I need to get some stuff off of. Because you can't always Google and find the information for free. Sometimes you need to go a little more, dig a little deeper, as I say. And so, definitely done that before.
Well, it's nice when you're traveling, too, because you don't have to take, like, a whole stack of books with you. When you travel, you can just take the Kindle and go with it, just down to the beach or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I used to always, like, agonize over which book am I taking on a trip. Because I know I can't take too many. So it's like, which one? And then if I pick the wrong one, then I'm like, oh, great, now here I'm on a 6-hour plane flight. This is this book that I've just been on the mood to read. But I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife keeps telling me that she's going to buy me a rolling library that I can sit there and I got wheels on it that I can just sort of pull behind me because I take so many with me almost every day.
Those are called wagons.
Yeah. No, what you need is a person like to be your like personal librarian or your book fellow. like a caddy except there's a book. That'd be great.
Yeah.
I think today you need the the Wagner.
Speaking of the Wagner, I would like to find out a little bit more about the newest book that he's got out.
You mean The Mouth of the Dark, that one?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the newest one. Yeah, that's the first book I did with Flame Tree Press, and it's another the kind of weird dark fantasy horror type stories that I do. And it's I was inspired to write it by watching an episode of Disappeared on Investigation Discovery, the Crime Channel, the Murder Channel. And I was just what they were, they'll sometimes have like marathons where they run one right after the other. And I was, like, doing something else while they were on. I'm like, I wonder if I could start a book with, somebody looking for a lost relative and then just kind of use that as the kernel to grow the story out of. So there's a man who's about my age in his early 50s whose daughter, who's in her 20s, early 20s, has just vanished. And he's trying to find her. And as he tries to find her, he finds out that she's been drawn into this, surreal, dark, shadowy world that exists alongside our own. And he finds himself becoming more and more pulled into it as he's looking for her. And in order to save her, he's going to have to become, just as bad, if not worse, than the kind of things that are in this world. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. It was a lot of fun to write. The other idea I had for it is a lot of times when I write these books, I don't use literal science fiction. but I use a premise that could be like a science fictional premise. So for this one, I thought, what if horror had an ecosystem? You know, where they had like dead apex predators, or you had like different kind of niches that the themes might fit into. And I use that as like another big part to try to grow the story from.
Yeah,
but everything happens
is
just weird fantasy, so.
And I can attest, having picked this up from Tim at Imaginarium, that it is definitely worth a read.
I appreciate that.
But
although people seem to be...
Also,
go ahead.
It's also known as In the Mouth of the Dork, isn't it?
Yes, you know, the first time somebody saw that, because of the typeface, the way they did the dark, the A looks like an O. I didn't notice that the first time. I never noticed that until somebody said it, and I'm like, oh, my God, well, I hope nobody else notices this. And, like, everybody knows this. Everybody. So I don't – that's just the way it is. So I guess, you know, if people call it the mouth of a dork, that's okay, but it's not a funny book like that. They're going to be a little bit
yeah.
a little informative of shock when they get in there.
Yeah.
As long as they're reading it, it doesn't matter what they call it.
That's exactly right. They kept the same typeface for the They Kill. I've got the cover, but I haven't had permission to share it yet. But they're using like the same exact typeface to kind of, I guess, brand me over at Flame Tree. But at least They Kill looks like They Kill.
I hope.
Very
cool.
I can't imagine right now. They Kill looks like. But everybody's thinking.
Yeah, I'm excited for They Kill based on what you've been teasing.
Yeah, I'm hoping people will like it. We'll see. I never know because I'll never know the parts that seem to disturb people. They always seem to do with sex, which I think is really interesting. You know, people don't care if you like rip off somebody's head in a book, but God forbid there should be any kind of element in sex.
Well, one of the best. Best upticks in sales I had was after somebody posted a review that of Poseidon's Children, where you know they all they wanted was a book on Greek mythology and they got sex. And I'm like, well, what Greek mythology have you ever read? Where there was sex?
Yes, no kidding.
I remember that. That was awesome. Oh man.
Maybe theirs is a different Greek mythology.
Yeah. They read the My First Greek Mythology book.
Oh man.
The Dr. Seuss like pictures or something. I don't know. But Zeus was a horn dog. Everybody knows it.
That's true.
But,
well, Tim,
I did want to ask
you before we get toward the final stretch of the show, as far as the horror genre goes, kind of like heavy metal, the horror genre never disappears. It's always there, and it's always got a definite diehard following. Sometimes it bursts into popularity, at certain degrees, and sometimes it ebbs, but it always has a certain following. Where do you think horror is at now, and what do you think as far as the prospects for horror as a genre in the near future, in terms of
the
public?
Yeah, it seems, according to my agent, horror is doing better than it used to. Not like thrillers or anything by any means, but you know, it sales wise and what publisher interest overall is up in it. It seems like there's a lot more. Recognition of horror as a genre, especially when you have the literary horror writers like Paul Tremblay, whose work's getting noticed, and Laird Barron and people like that, that, you know, it's not just horror readers and horror fans. It's readers in general and critics in general and reviewers in general. And then a lot of the really good horror movies that have come out in the last few years, like Hereditary and Quiet Place, that are getting people's attention. Well, and even The Shape of Water, you know, who winning Oscars and things. So I think that horror's visibility as a genre is rising, And, you know, that sometimes, you know, they say that that happens whenever times are tough or times are uncertain or there's a lot of stress in the country. So who knows, an election or two from now, that might change. And maybe horror will be on the wane again. But it seems to me like that it is picking up. And I think the streaming services help a lot because there's just a lot of horror movies there for people to sample, and they can sample them any time. And I think that people are, like, experiencing them more. You know, it's not like you have to go pick one for pay-per-view. You've already paid for the service. And so it's like there's all this stuff you can explore. And so, you know, we'll see. But I think that there's probably, you know, there's always going to be room for just kind of fun sort of horror that in a lot of ways is just like comic book horror, which is, you know, not literally, but I mean it's just kind of just for fun. But I think that, you know, in a lot of ways the genre, at least in America, I think it's grown up. And I think there's just going to be a lot more potential to it. I also think that there's a lot more horror elements showing up in other kinds of media as well. And I think it's just something that people are getting used to or embracing more. It's what I want to believe anyway.
No, I'd have to say, Tim, I agree with you. I mean, I definitely see that, you know, I think there's been an uptick for sure. And yeah, but even in times when times, you know, even are going fairly well, sometimes horror does boom. Like, I'm speaking just as a child of the 80s, you know, and there definitely was a great decade, you know, for horror too. And, definitely, I mean, you just never know when it's going to kind of explode into the public consciousness. But yeah, I think that the current, we were talking about movies earlier, but Hellfest, you know, being a gem that Michael West was talking about earlier, and Halloween on the big screen, and of course a lot of great horror video game titles, I think, that have been coming out in the last year or so. And I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that we've got a lot of stuff driving right now that kind of indicates that it's definitely on the upswing. And that definitely filters over to our book world too. And I think pretty good times are ahead. Yeah, a lot of good presses out there doing a lot of things.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting stuff happening on YouTube as well with, you know, the Marble Hornets kind of creating Slender Man, and you know, you discover the story by accessing all these different videos and looking at the little pieces. There's a gentleman that goes by the name Nick Nocturne who does his show is all about like looking for, you know, horror in different forms like this. And so he'll find like a video game that is like a hidden horror game. You don't know it's horror until you've played through it for a while. Or he'll find like this YouTube series that looks like it's supposed to be a kid show from the 80s, but the more you watch it, the more it descends into some kind of weird horror. And so he's always looking for these like innovative narratives. And so there's all kinds of stuff that's going on. It's a really exciting time to be a horror writer and fan.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree.
And now I'm gonna swing it over to another direction here for you, Tim. And it's for a writer such as yourself who has written in a lot of genres and done so very successfully, and you know, definitely, you know, you've had a wonderful career so far. What literary project have you not tackled yet? What type or genre or type of literary work have you not tackled yet that really interests you that you would like to do to have in your body of work?
Maybe like a straight mystery series. I mean, with my Necropolis books, I mean, the character is a zombie detective, so there's a little bit of that, but I've always found the mystery series really interesting. I don't really care about the crime from book to book because I never remember them, but I always find the characters interesting and how they develop over time. So I think that would be fun. I think it might be fun to try to do a straight thriller too, because it would mean that I couldn't do all the weird stuff that I usually like to do. So it would be more like, what could I do with a more constrained set of elements? You know, could I find a way to use, you know, all the kinds of stuff I do when I write horror, but do it in a more realistic way? So I think that might be a lot of fun.
Freak.
Probably those two things.
Well, that's very good because, yeah, Michael's answer, of course, is erotica for his career, but, you know, that's a whole other topic.
Hey, you know, don't knock it. It seems to sell, at least on, you know, if you publish it yourself.
Oh, no, it does. No, I always kid Michael about that, though. The Michael West erotica.
Well, you know, I'll never forget the time that somebody came up to my table when I had walked away, and my my youngest son, who is taller than I am, but is manning the table, and this woman comes up and says, "So are these monster porn?"
Oh my God! Like, I guess it makes sense. You know that.
Yeah.
People find it online, so.
Yeah, and of course he's like mortified, trying to. Kind of, I guess.
No, the answer to that is yes. Yes, it is.
That's what I told him. That's what I told him. I said, when someone asks you that, you say yes.
Yeah, it's like Ghostbusters. You
right.
Say yes, Rick.
Well, I love when in Michael's Legacy of the God series, in a certain illustration where there's like a spider creature and another one. I love watching people's eyes widen when they realize what's going on in that scene.
Right. Yeah, the dragon and spider centaur love scene is now stuff of legend.
There you go.
Yeah, I've actually watched people's faces, and it is fun to watch their reaction as it dawns on them what's going on.
Well, I had the one witch story, which somehow became known as, are we in the after hour now?
Oh, we're close. We still got 4 minutes of the live show left.
it's Jerry Gordon read this story when before I was marketing it and trying to get it sold, and he read it and called it the tree effing story, and it kind of stuck. So it's like everybody referred to it as the tree effing story.
Oh man, that's too good.
It's called The Grove.
Well, I do know for the record that was one of Matt Perry's favorite illustrations to do for Michael's work, was that particular one that I mentioned earlier. Yes.
Well, and I tried to give him an easy out. I tried to say, well, if you want to, like, have shadows behind the... Because it took place in a hospital bed. So I said, if you want to have, like, shadows behind a curtain or something, you know, just kind of, like, suggesting. And oh, no, he went full throttle with
it. Yeah. And he did it in such a way that it did not cause us any problem with distribution or anything. It was beautiful. He just hit everything just perfectly.
I remember Steve's only critique was, we just can't see the dragon's nipples.
It was genius. He did a perfect job, yeah.
That is so funny.
No, yeah, we've gotten a lot of mileage out of the years on that one, yeah.
Like
that was a fun one.
When they say the movie previews and it's rated R4 and they list all this weird stuff, so they have to list like dragon nipples on the
right.
Yes.
Right. Well, that was cracking me up with Team America, World Police, where they list, you know, sex, violence, drugs, all this stuff is all involving puppets.
Oh man. Yeah, that's too much. That's too much. But now, as far as other spheres are concerned, as far as like writing for, say, games or you know other types of media, do you have any interest in that at all? At this, as far as like the moving forward.
No, not really. You know, I mean, if I wasn't teaching as well, maybe because I'd have more time to do stuff probably. I sometimes think it would be interesting to try to write a horror play, like maybe a short one.
That would be awesome.
I haven't done it yet, but, you know, I wrote a couple plays in college and produced one. But.
Well, I know that was a big part of Clive Barker's work was playwriting. And, I can definitely see you coming with something from your work in that angle, for sure. That would be awesome.
I think it'd be interesting to see if you could create, you know, that kind of effect on a stage. Because, you know, you're there with just people. You know it's fake. It's absolutely fake. It's even more fake than a movie. Because you could run up and interact with those people if you wanted to. But I just haven't gotten around to it. I've, you know, I've tinkered with a couple ideas, but nothing's happened yet. So maybe that, but otherwise, no, not really.
So there's always something fun about the stage because there's always, you know, like I said, you can't do a second take. I mean, everything's
right.
Live, everything's happening. I mean, what happens, happens. And
right.
that's one of the cool things that I love about the stage. And yeah, if you could bring something, yeah, with a speculative fiction realm into that live kind of environment on the stage, I mean, that would be awesome. I would love to see you tackle that.
Yes, maybe someday.
Hopefully when you get more time after teaching, yeah, you'll be able to jump on that one a little bit. Now, when you do decide not to do classes, and right now we're entering the bonus phase of the Star Chamber show, and of course, you know, most of our listenership does pick up this version for stream and download. I'll just mention that real quick. But as far as you know, once you're done with the formal academia phase, what are you going to also continue doing a lot of workshop type work and things like that?
Oh yeah, I don't think I'll ever stop doing that until I can't do it anymore.
Well,
and
you're young.
I hope
so you got time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess youngish anyway, I suppose.
Right. Well, that's definitely good. Definitely good news for all the folks that have been catching you in the workshops at Imaginarium. Yeah, I know that for a fact. So as far as finding you online too, I do want to ask that before we get toward the close of the show here. Where would you like fans to find you online?
Well, the simplest thing is to go to my website. Just timwagner.com, because I have a contact page there with links to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and my blog, and you can sign up with my newsletter. So, you know, that would be the easiest.
Okay. Yeah, because I think I'm following you on everything you've got there on what you listed there. As far Daniel.
Do what?
Do you have anything left that we haven't covered that you would like to ask Tim?
That I would like to ask Tim. How many?
Yes.
Tim, how many writing books do you have right now in your written library, the ones that you've written in conjoining with other people?
So you mean books about writing?
Books about writing.
Well,
so people
yeah,
can
well,
know what you've got out there.
Yeah, you know, I've done chapters in books like Writer's Workshop of Horror, edited by Michael Nost, and Where Nightmares Come from Crystal Lake, Horror 101 and 102 from Crystal Lake, I think I've got stuff in. I got a proposal out for a book on horror writing just by me, and maybe somebody will pick it up eventually. And if they do, I'll write it. So I might have one of my own before too long.
Very good, very good. That you know,
very cool.
I'm waiting to get my copy of your horror writing book that Michael Nost edited.
That's
so.
Right. Yeah. There's one where Michael and I have you know, it's like 50-50. It's just, you know, it's articles from both of us about writing.
Mm-hmm. Are any of those in e-book? Or in
right now, I think
digital,
it's just print.
Audio?
It's going to be ebook eventually, I believe. I don't know about audio yet, but I think digital's in the works right now.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to get some things like that to go in when I'm driving, just
mm-hmm.
plug into the car so I can listen to things
yep.
like that while I'm riding. So.
Yep.
Yeah, when he says car, he means his 1901 Oldsmobile. So he goes about 20 miles an hour, and he's on back roads. So yeah, he needs something that can occupy him for a while.
I get there.
That's what we need. Is next year when you get Tim, either in that or your famous penny. Oh man, your bike, my
penny farthing.
The penny. Yes.
Farthing.
Well, that book that you did with Michael Nost, I'm real excited about.
Oh, I don't know if Tim heard you, Michael.
Oh yeah.
Hopefully it'll be available for too awfully long. Michael and I need to get together so we can, like, sign them all. And as soon as we do that.
Very cool.
Yeah, I want to add my name to the mix there as far as the readers that are looking forward to devouring that one for sure. So.
Yeah.
But Michael, do you have anything left to cover? We've covered a lot of ground tonight with Tim.
Well, with Tim, I should throw this out there that Tim is the one and only time that I've ever done a collaboration. It was with Tim, and I had always been hesitant to do a collaboration just because I didn't know how much input I would have or. And it was probably one of the greatest writing experiences of my life, really, just because it was so much fun, and just the way we would, I would leave it at a certain point, and then Tim would take over, and he'd leave it at basically a cliffhanger, and I'd be like, oh, okay, I was supposed to pick up from that, okay, and just. The way we were able to make it not feel like it was two different people, the way that we were able to kind of imitate each other's style enough that it felt like it was, it wasn't you can't really, if you look at it, I hope you can't, but, pick out who did what at what time, but it was just a wonderful experience, and it just shows, what I've always said about Tim all along is that Tim is a writer's writer. And that, just he's all about helping writers be the best that they can be. And just, he loves the craft of writing and it shows.
Yeah. That story was a lot of fun to write. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to find another way to bring Ellie and Ness and the Supernatural back together.
That would be cool. That would be cool.
I've got one final question for Tim. What was the first horror character that you wrote, and how old were you when you wrote it?
First character, it was probably King Kong and Godzilla. Because I was probably second or third grade, and I'd never seen the movie, but I would read Famous Monsters magazine, and I saw pictures that there was a movie where these guys fought, and so I created a comic book version of it in a stenographer's pad. You had to flip it, turn it sideways, flip it to read it, and then I tried to write some text in it too, and I remember. There's always a picture of King Kong and Godzilla on either side of some. There's some building in Japan that has very Asian architecture, and I had no idea what to call it. And so I remember that I had heard the word geisha, so I called it the Geisha House. And so I had King Kong and Godzilla destroying the Geisha House. I had no idea what that was. And when I found out years later, I'm like, oh my God. So, even back then, I was a lazy researcher. I thought to myself, that's probably close enough. It's probably good. So I guess that would be the first official one that I ever did.
Well, that's great.
I remember one of the first horror stories I did was based on a campfire story I had heard, and the person had done this campfire story, and I'm like going, I should take that and just adapt it and make it into a story. So I did, and then I came to find out years later, as I was watching an old episode of Night Gallery, that all this person did was basically retell a Night Gallery around the campfire. So basically, I did a story version of a Night Gallery episode that already.
That's funny. Well, how are you to know?
Right. Right.
So you're lucky the ghost of Rod Serling didn't show up to get after you.
That's right.
Oh, man. Well, Tim, is there anything that we have not covered tonight that you were hoping to get out there to the public?
No, this has been great. We've had a great conversation and covered a lot more than I thought we would. It's been wonderful.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear that because, yeah, with your body of work and everything else, you know, yeah, definitely there's quite a lot we could delve into and talk about. So I'm glad to hear that you feel we've covered the bases. So hope, yeah, definitely you've had a good time on the show. We definitely want to have you back in 2019 for sure to update us on some of the new releases coming up and everything happening with you.
Yeah, that'd be
great.
It's
been a pleasure listening to you.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And happy Halloween.
Yep,
happy Halloween. Yeah, we couldn't have had a more perfect guest for Halloween. That's for certain. So thank you for being willing to join us on a Halloween night, Tim.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And Michael and Daniel, any final statements?
Just get out there and get writing.
That's right.
That's right.
I horror is like I was saying earlier, horror for a horror writer, Halloween is 365 days of the year, but Halloween is still special. So it was really special to spend Halloween with Tim.
Oh, thank you.
Most definitely, Tim. And yeah, I feel the same way. And yeah, thank you very much for joining us. And yeah, of course, every week at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we have the Star Chamber Show, and definitely want to power creatives each and every week. So thank you very much for joining us, and have a good night, everybody, and go check out Tim Wagner.
Good night,
everybody. Happy Halloween.